I'm curious about the 100-year mindset. You work for a 100-year institution, and it's a big overlap with what we do and where we come from. So as a firm, we're only 6 years old, but as a team, we've worked together for 20 years. And the clients we work with, my senior partner worked with since 1969, and then his late partner worked with even before. But the roots of those fortunes go back to mid-1800s or even before. So we are familiar with a 100-year or a 200-year view. Can you talk more about working for a 100-year institution and how it shapes your investment approach and thinking?
I think it's a differentiator also philosophically. I think that the most important thing also is that we're a family enterprise. The big banks in Europe say they're client-centric, but there are other things that come into play that distract from the client center. And I think in a smaller organization, that's easier done. And as a family, you have been here. Your father is here. Your grandfather has been here. You're here. Your children might be here. Your daughter might come and take charge. And I think that gives you this sense of continuity, and it gives you a time frame that's not only the next quarter, but it gives you a time frame that's over generations. And I think that's also a good bridge to our clients, where wealth is also then transferred through different generations, and the thinking goes on and on. And I always like to say that wealth can live on forever and also can do a lot of good things in the world. And so I think the responsibility for caring for that wealth is important, and it's something that I like to have.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, investor, and a founding partner of Sicard Associates, a boutique investment firm founded in New York City. Join me on this quest to unearth the wisdom of the ages. My guest today is Robert Karas. He's a partner and chief investment officer at Bank Gutmann in Vienna, Austria. He's a fellow Guy Spears ValueX attendee. He calls himself an investor on a lifelong journey. I'm a big fan of his newsletter, which you can find on LinkedIn. The link is in the notes. Robert has a way of presenting familiar ideas in a new, fresh, and thoughtful way. I think that any seasoned and new investor would benefit from reading them. I highly recommend checking out his earlier posts, especially the ones written during the last crisis, the global COVID pandemic. Today we talk about Robert's childhood and upbringing and his investing journey. He shared with me his experience working for a 100-year-old institution and how that influences the type of clients he works with and the type of investment philosophy that his firm pursues. We discuss the benefits of writing and how writing can make us better investors. Robert likes to call himself an outsider, and he explains why that helps in his work. I especially like how he refers to the life of an investor as being monk-like. He shares how an investment team resembles monks and nuns in a monastery. Stay tuned until the end to find out why Robert believes that it doesn't pay to get completely out of the market at any point in time, no matter what's happening. I greatly enjoyed our conversation. I hope to continue to learn from Robert and follow his writing. After we stopped recording, I shared with Robert that Vienna was the first Western European city I saw as a kid. Poland, where I grew up, was just ending its failed experiment with a centrally planned Soviet-style economy. I have vivid memories of Vienna as being colorful and alive compared to my early childhood Poland, which was gray, but about to dramatically change as the Cold War came to an end and the Iron Curtain just fell. Without further ado, please help me welcome Robert Karas from Bank Gutmann in Vienna, Austria.
Hello, dear listener. I have a small favor to ask. If you're enjoying the show, please follow, subscribe, and most of all, share with everyone that would like it too. It's all word of mouth marketing. It's all up to your fingertips to make a small contribution and become an important part of the success of the show. Thank you.
Hello, Robert. How are you? Nice to see you again.
Hi, Bogumil. Good seeing you.
We met at ValueX. I really enjoyed your talks, and I was looking forward to catching up with you and exploring a little bit more your writing, your ideas, the firm you work at, and just a general mindset that you have, and we'll talk more about it, but it has major overlaps with what we do. I'd like to start from the beginning, if you let me, and I'm always curious to hear about my guests and their childhood and upbringing and how they believe that shaped their relationship with money and eventually paved the way to your career and your interest in investing.
I was raised in Vienna, and I had no relation to money, so to speak. My parents never talked about money with me, so that was not really a thing, unfortunately, because I'm doing it differently now. I try to talk about the importance of savings and how to look at money. So I think, especially in Austria, we have way to go to have better financial education for our children. Where the whole thing started for me was after school, I had my first job, not related to finance. And it was at the end of the 80s, and there was the big bull market on the Austrian Stock Exchange. Jim Rogers was the one that kissed it awake. He published an article in Barron's. The Viennese Stock Exchange took off, and it was a bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And towards the end of the bubble, I said, oh, that's great. It's a way to get rich quickly, and I want to work in that area. So I was talking to banks, and I was applying for jobs. Mm-hmm. And I got into one, and I would have been able to get into a number of banks, but the one I joined, I was able to work directly in the securities department that started the path actually in the year 1990. And since then, the red line through all the things I've done were the markets and investing.
Wow, what a journey. I'm curious about the 100-year mindset. You work for a 100-year institution, and it's a big overlap with what we do and where we come from. So as a firm, we're only 6 years old, but as a team, we've worked together for 20 years. And the clients we work with, my senior partner worked with since 1969, and then his late partner worked with even before. But the roots of those fortunes go back to mid-1800s or even before. So we are familiar with a 100-year or a 200-year view. Can you talk more about working for a 100-year institution and how it shapes your investment approach and thinking?
I think it's a differentiator also philosophically. I think that the most important thing also is that we're a family enterprise. And there are not many banks left that are in family hands in Austria. There are only two or three banks left.
Maybe in the world.
I think if I look to Switzerland, I think there are many more family-owned or banks that have a long history. But in Austria, also because of the war, obviously, there was a big interruption, a lot of unfortunate developments during the Second World War. And also Goodman was affected because the Goodman brothers started the bank 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But then everything was stolen, obviously, during Second World War. It was a Jewish family. And after the war, one brother came back and the bank license lifted up again. And the partner in the bank was Karl Kahane, who is an industrial legend in Austria. And the Kahane family still owns the bank till today. And I think this continuity and also our partner system that employees of the bank can become partners, that makes a difference, I think, from the mindset, being more entrepreneurial, putting the clients first. Just this week, I talked to one of my colleagues who is a board member of the bank. And after the conversation, we reflected and said, how many banks out there are there where the board member and the chief investment officer talk about one client and what are the needs of this one client, and are we fulfilling the needs? Are we on the right path? Probably not many. So I think that's the ethos. The ethos is it's really about success is how our clients are doing, and are we making them happy or are we making them unhappy?
Do you think that because it's a 100-year-old institution, it attracts different clientele?
I think the 100 years, that is a message to the outside world that they're still in existence, so there must be something that is enduring. Mm-hmm. But I think from the inside, what is more important is the culture. And I mm-hmm. think the culture is really client-centric, because everyone talks about, we are all client-centric. And even the big the big banks in Europe say they're client-centric. But there are other things that come into play that distract from the client center. And I think in a smaller organization, that's easier done. And as a family, you have been here, your father is here, your grandfather has been here, you're here, your children might be here, your daughter might come and take charge. And I think that gives you this sense of continuity, and it gives you a time frame that's not only the next quarter, but it gives you a time frame that's over generations. And I think that's also a good bridge to our clients, where wealth is also then transferred through different generations, and the thinking goes on and on. And I always like to say that wealth can live on forever and also can do a lot of good things in the world. And so I think the responsibility for caring for that wealth is important, and it's something that I like to have.
It sounds like it attracts a certain type of potential employee and a potential client. I'm thinking that the turnover among large institutions is so high, and what we hear from clients is that they like that every time they call, it's one of the same people they always talk to. And these are the people that already know their story. And the stories we hear from other institutions is that every time you call, it's a different client relationship person, and they come and go and leave, and they don't really know the story. And how can they serve you as a client well if they don't really know you? And I think that's the big opportunity for the firms like yours or ours. And I think a challenge for large institutions that can't keep the talent. And then how can you keep a client? So that's an interesting phenomenon. So we both know that investors read. I don't know an investor that doesn't read. And a lot of them write. Some of them I know they write just for themselves. They journal. It's a big thing. And I think it helps all of us become better investors. But some of us write and publish. And you and I both publish what we write. And I'm curious about your experience. And you write in two languages at the same time. So you made it even more difficult for yourself. Tell me more about the experience of writing regularly and sharing your thoughts with the public, what it's been like.
Yeah, Bogomil, and I've been also reading your writing on your website. And I see there is a strong overlap in philosophy and who are our heroes and what we think is right in life and in investing. So yeah, that's a great one. Funny thing is, I haven't been really writing like I did over the last 2 years in the past. I mean, mm-hmm. I've always written some parts internally when I was with different firms, and so there was something in me that wanted to write things down and then share it with others. But it all changed during COVID because there was this urgent need of information. So in 2020, spring of 2020, I came to the office at 7 o'clock in the morning for weeks and published an internal newsletter every day. But that was very different from what I do today. It was more gathering the information, gathering research, putting pictures out there, charts, and my interpretation to it, and helping my colleagues to stay up to date with the rapid changes that happened in the markets, in society, in regulations, and so on. And after some time, some client relationship manager said, we need something for our clients. And then I pivoted and went to a weekly newsletter where I actually write the same thing over and over again.
Yeah. It's not entirely true, but...
and try to package it differently. But my big hero in that regard is Jason Zweig of Wall Street Journal. That's what I'm aspiring to. I'm far away from his style. He's so much better. But anyways, he always says he has been writing the same thing for 20 or 30 years, and he just hopes that his readers and the editors don't recognize it. And now I can relate to that because there are some underlying truth, or what I believe is the truth, or is the right thing, and then you try to transport it to the current events and make it interesting to read. Because I think the financial industry puts so much stuff out there that no one reads, and it's so boring. And so My rule number one was, I don't want to bore anyone with it.
You're not. So I had a similar experience. As you know, I write every 2 weeks or so. But during the peak of COVID, I was writing every week because we were taking quite a few calls from clients. And I thought, I want everybody to be on the same page. So I was writing every week for, I think, a year and a half, maybe almost 2 years. And it was a really good practice to have your thoughts organized. And it wasn't a market commentary, but it was a refresher on the principles that guide us. And I thought of those essays as something that anybody can pick up at the moment or 5, 10, 50 years from now and still find relevant. but have a little bit of flavor of the backdrop of when I'm writing it and why am I writing about it now, whether it was patience, whether it was fear, whatever was happening at the time. And I thought it was a really great experience for me as an investor, and I think it helped our clients too. You mentioned a little bit about your daily routine, but I'm curious, what is your daily routine? You seem to be an early riser. You seem to do a lot in your day and week. What's your routine like every day, if you don't mind sharing?
I have two older kids, but they're already, so the oldest one is in his own apartment, so they're not living with me, the older ones. But I also have two smaller kids, and they are 5 and 6.5. And anyone who has or had children in that age knows that when they are around, you don't get many things done because they are the center of the focus, and that's fine. So you have to think about when is my time, when is time with my partner and myself, when is time for myself to stay fit or to read or to write or do whatever. And then you play around with the 24 hours, and you can do it either in the evening or in the morning normally, or when they are in kindergarten or school. So for me and also my wife, what worked best is getting up early. So we are getting up earlier and earlier. So it was like 6 and then 5:30 and then 5:20, and now I'm at 5:15. I try to get a workout in the morning. So to start doing something, working out, I think that gives you a very energetic start into the day. But writing for the newsletter is a weekly piece, and it's about a 3-minute read. So I try to start 1 week before and write something, a few sentences, and then it's every day I'm turning to it again and changing a little bit, adding a sentence, and then I hope at the end of the week, coming Friday when I publish it, that it is finished. I like how Vitaly Katsenelson does it. I think he gets up even earlier and then writes in the morning, like 2 hours or so. So I'm not there yet. So for me, it's a more scattered approach during the week.
I can relate, and I find it hard to sit down and write the entire piece. And even if I do, I rewrite it after that. So it's very helpful to write down a few ideas and let the rest of the week fill in the gaps and see where it goes. Again, I hope that by the end of the week, I have something ready for that following date.
Exactly.
But it's sort of the deadline puts pressure, and I see how the ideas start to shape up, and it's nice to have that kind of routine and repetition. In one of your essays, you write many interesting things, but one thing that stood out to me, you talk about a large amount that suddenly needs to be invested. And I don't know if you remember that particular essay, but I'd be curious to hear what advice you have for people that experience it. And quite a few of our clients either inherit substantial wealth, and although they knew it was coming, the actual transfer may feel sudden, or the responsibility is sudden, or they sold a business, or they received a big compensation because of their career. So as much of it was expected, the actual experience always feels sudden. I always hear the word sudden, and you mentioned sudden in your essay. So I see that you noticed the same phenomenon. Can you talk more about it? What recommendation, advice you have for somebody that experiences sudden wealth one way or the other?
Yeah, that's true. I've wrote about that because that's what I encounter again and again, and that's also what shapes the topics of the newsletter. Is if I come across something, a client says something or read something, and then topic starts in my brain, and it was, as you say, there are people or families that either inherit wealth or they sell the company, or over the years they accumulate profits within the company or in dividends from their own company up to a certain size, and then they see, okay, now we have to invest it. And often there are a lot of conversations about what strategy and how much ups and downs of the markets can you really bear, especially if you have not a lot of experience in financial markets. You're sometimes shocked how far equities can fall, and since last year, how far bonds can fall.
Yes.
And so the question is, how should I invest and how to start? Because even if you have decided on everything, you said, okay, let's take the classical 60-40 portfolio. Okay, I want to have 60% in equities, 40% in bonds, and you give all the guidelines how that should be done. And now how do we start? Do we invest it all on day one, or do we scale into it over 6 months, 12 months, 3 weeks? So there are a gazillion ways to do it. Statistically, you probably should implement it immediately. Because markets rise over time, markets go up stairs and go down the elevator. So even if you take only the time element and not the, the magnitude element, so just looking at it from different statistical viewpoints, you're probably best off to do it immediately. But psychologically, you have to do it to limit remorse. Because if you put it in immediately, and it's something like summer 2007, and the great financial crisis in front of you, it's just very difficult to accept that it was still the best thing to do, because your individual experience is very negative. So often you have to do something that might not mathematically be the optimum, but it's the best way to limit remorse. So I'm always thinking, what could go wrong, and how can I protect the client? Because I think we are so benchmark oriented, and everyone wants to beat the benchmark. But for me, that's not the number one priority. What I see, especially with private clients and also trusts and endowments that are organized differently in Austria than in US, that the big challenge is how do you get the client through the first down cycle where there will be an element of disappointment, where they said, oh, why didn't you get us out before the downturn? And this is some learning involved in that. And so you have to make sure that they that the trust stays intact and you lead the client through the difficult phase and to the other side. And so often we start maybe with a with an equity allocation that's lower than intended to keep the fluctuation slower, and then clients start to live with their portfolio on a daily basis. And in the beginning, they're always very interested. They might look at the numbers every day, and then after some time, every week, and then they don't look at it for months, even if trust is there. So I think that's the thought I played around with. So when to invest and how much to invest.
I like that. To me, the biggest difference is if you have two situations. One, somebody that chooses to invest the same amount, let's say every month, and saves $100 or $1,000 and puts it to whatever the investments they choose. They have time to make mistakes. They have time to get comfortable with the volatility. And then they don't really have to time the market because they put a little bit every month over next decade or 2 decades or 3 decades. Now, if you get a phone call and you find out that you have substantial life-changing wealth come to you pretty much in a single day sometimes, it's a very different mindset. You have a lot less room to make mistakes, however you define the mistakes, you know, commission, omission, and missing out on opportunity or losing the money, and everybody has their own way of interpreting it. But it's a very different proposition than you having a lifetime to learn and you really taking on a responsibility overnight. And I'm glad how you framed it. And I like the remark that you make about the first downturn, because any new client that goes for a first big downturn with us, it's a learning experience for both sides, because we can hypothesize what it will feel like, but to actually go through it, sit down and look at the value and remember that it was higher than, it used to be higher than it is now, and going through the process of explaining where we are, where we're going, I think it's eye-opening. But I would add that going for a big upcycle, a big bull market, is also eye-opening how the client will respond. And I call it the moment when the neighbor is getting richer faster than you. Somehow, it's a big challenge for a lot of people. Have you noticed that too? That it's not just the downside, but other people getting richer faster than the client. And there are phone calls and conversations that are triggered by it.
Sure. That's, I think, one of the hallmarks of a good bull market that develops into a bubble. I think the last thing that came up was probably crypto, where you probably also noticed that the interest picked up with the pace of rising prices in the crypto space, and then it collapsed, and then no one wants to talk about it anymore. So I think that's one of the typical examples.
We had nothing to do with it. We didn't participate, as you can imagine, but we were part of conversations as people arguing why it makes sense. And it was, some of them were really seasoned investors that I've seen go through ups and downs, and I thought they've seen it all, and they were giving in. So fear of missing out can get to anybody, no matter how experienced you are. And I was a bit shocked seeing how many really smart people with a lot of experience gave in. I'm curious about the idea of being an outsider. Like reading your essays, and you mentioned that you and your firm, you're an outsider in many ways, and we call ourselves contrarians. I think it's tomato, tomato at the end. It's the same term. basically you buy when others sell, and you sell, or we trim at least when other people are too enthusiastic. That's how we like to operate. It takes a lot of emotional discipline. Can you talk about being an outsider and what it takes to be able to maintain that mindset?
I was just struck after the. I just noticed in recent weeks that so many private banks talk about the economy and send out essays and reports where they say the PMI is this and some other numbers, and because of that we are positioning our portfolio like that. And I think, first of all, I think that's not really what they do, but they want to tell that story because it sounds so so smart and based into science and economic reality. And I just wanted to say, we are not even pretending that this is the way we do it, because I think the stock market, if you look back, sure, the stock market and the economic development overlaps, but it's only because you have the numbers that are like 6 months old or so that you overlap. Most of the time, recession is declared when it's already over. And then you say, oh, yeah, there was a recession. Oh, yeah, the market went down. But we didn't know back then that it was a recession. And sometimes the market is even wrong and turns around. So I don't think that's the way we should explain the clients, because then the clients say, oh, now the economy is doing this and that, and the stock market is doing something completely different. Oh, that's only speculative, and the stock market has nothing to do with the real economy. And that's not true. I mean, the stock market is always anticipating things and moving completely different from the underlying economy, because it's always trading the next day's news and not what's happening today. And I wanted to put that on paper, because I think there's also magic in putting it on paper or writing it down, because then you have to be concise. We all can argue all kind of things while talking, but if you have to write it down, then you're accountable, and then anyone can say, okay, I agree with what you say, or I don't agree, and then we have a good basis for a discussion. And that's why I talked about it. And first of all, I think we are the result of the stories we tell ourselves.
Right.
If you tell yourself every day you're a lunatic, then at some point you'll certainly be crazy. So it's better to tell yourself, I'm strong and resilient and I'm someone who works out every day, and then you'll do it, and things like that. So we all know we have to tell us the positive stories. So, by telling, that's the way how we think. I'm telling it to myself, I'm telling it to our clients, but I'm also telling it to my colleagues. So that's the ethos I want to implement in the heads of my colleagues, is that we want to be contrarian. We want to be not carried. Don't want to be carried away by a big wave. We are a small organization, but we're still 250 people. I think it's also important to get a certain culture and philosophy within. You have to implement it in the whole organization. And the best way to do is to be redundant and tell the same thing over and over again. So I think in our space, you cannot be too redundant.
No,
you can be boring, okay, but you have to avoid that. But you have to hammer home your message in a way.
The consistency of the message really matters, and we all forget, or we think we remember. So it's nice to go back and remember, especially in times when it's a trying time and it's really difficult to be patient, either on the way down or on the way up.
That's true. I mean, if you just you probably also read and listen to Ryan Holiday's on the Stoics.
Yes.
I mean, the Stoics, they were not invented yesterday, but no. It's still appealing, and we still love to read these stories. So,
That's so true. And when I read some of those pieces and I forget for a second when they were written, they could have been written at home on a laptop yesterday by somebody observing their life. And it's incredible how relevant the human experience, how timeless the human experience is, and how we're all facing the same problems, whether we have, you know, horses and living in Roman times, or we have cars and laptops in today's times. The one thing that you mentioned, the market and the economy, the stock market and the economy, and we often write that they're not the same, and there's a lot of confusion about it. And there are those questions that you mentioned, the economy is allegedly not doing so well. Should we be out of the market? And it's usually the worst thing you can do. But as an extreme example, I'm thinking of some of the tech companies that, because of this slowdown, are letting people go. So they make those announcements where they're firing so many people, and then the stock goes up. And I think that summarizes it the best. So you have an alleged recession or a slowdown. Well, they're responding to it by cutting their costs. And since the costs will go down, the profits will go up. And the market actually acknowledges the fact, oh, it will be a higher margin, maybe healthier, better managed business down the road. So it's not correlated the way people think. The economy is bad, the market will be bad. And actually, there are big lags. The market bottomed in March of 2020. The economy didn't bottom really until a few months later. And the market was already back up by the time the actual economy bottomed. So I think it's very important to remember that distinction between the market and the economy. They're not one and the same. And let's not forget that the actual businesses behind the stock prices that we see, right?
So true. And if you look right now, if you look at the big brand companies, the consumer goods companies like Nestle, Unilever, Procter & Gamble, Kimberly-Clark, and so on, if you look over the recent quarters, they all lost volume. So that's what you right. will read in the media. So we are selling less volume of this and that. But who cares about volume, really? What is relevant is the revenue and your profit margin on it. And what we have observed over the last few quarters is that they all were able to raise the prices double digit,
yes.
While losing volume in the neighborhood of 1, 2, 3%. So the revenue is going up, the profit margins are stable. So that's why equities are inflation protection. Mm-hmm. But then you get a pushback because clients say, but these companies have been down and they haven't protected me against inflation. And I think that's the price you pay for it. The price is that it doesn't work in every single year, but it will work over time. So you have to earn it and deserve it to get that entrepreneurial return over mm-hmm. time by not panicking out at the wrong time and trying to time it, as you also mentioned before. But over time, it will work out. They'll raise prices, profit margins are stable, then that you will be fine over time.
Well, it leads me to the next question. And I wrote down a quote from one of your essays about accumulating knowledge. You write how it should be accumulated in silence. An investment team should resemble monks and nuns in a monastery. And if I'm correct, you call yourself a value monk yourself. Tell me more about that.
Yeah. I think there's always this perception how investments are done from the outside. So they think it's, they all have this, I think still the 1987 Wall Street movie with Michael Douglas with the phones and hectic buying and selling.
Right.
And then if you enter an investment company that does fundamental research, yeah, you're reminded more of a monastery than a trading floor because people are reading, they're reading annual reports, they're reading research, maybe they write something down. So it's a very quiet environment. It's very different, I think, from the inside than what people perceive from the outside.
The work happens quietly, and it's not about the action, but about learning about businesses and being ready to act in certain moments. But it's not daily action. I think that's very true. And Hollywood created the wrong image of the actual real life investment environment, especially the one that focuses on the long term. You write about losses. And it's a really interesting topic because people come to investing to make money and the topic of losses gets overlooked, or the risk and the downside. But the remark that you make, I thought, was really interesting, how we all get too conservative right after recent market events. And you hinted it a little bit just now when we were talking about the economy and concerns that people have. Let's talk about losses. How should we deal with them as investors? And then that moment right after a correction or weaker market when we just get too conservative and we might be missing out on a move.
The whole thing started for me during the great 2008, 2009 downturn.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was, for example, invested in Walmart in a fund I managed. And I kept Walmart because it held up so well during the depression, so to speak, and during the bear market. And I should have sold more stocks on the cheap to buy cheaper. Right. And because many people during a bear market say, oh, we are upgrading the quality of the portfolio. But mm-hmm. what they're really saying is we are getting more defensive. And so I'm really questioning that. And
right.
last year was not the biggest downturn we have ever experienced, but it was a pretty long and might still be a pretty long bear market. And a lot has happened to the sentiment of investors. So there's measurable sentiment. You'll know these different indicators you can look at, and there was some objective the froth has been taken off, so to speak. So crypto was not a topic anymore, and all these millions of brokerage accounts that were open, they were not probably not very active anymore because the money was gone. So a lot of these bull market excesses were gone. After such a year, it's very questionable if you then start getting even more conservative, no matter on the bond side, or on the equity side, or on the bond side, because then a lot of damage already has happened. So I think you should at least keep up the pace. If your strategy is to have a certain exposure and certain equities, you should not go out completely. So let's think you got out of all the tech stocks at the end of 22. That would not have been right. I mean, you always have to freshly underwrite your investment idea. You still have to challenge yourself. Is my assumption still correct? Is the business model still going in the right direction? But you should not then go out completely of tech stocks and go all into healthcare, because the first 3 months of this year would have been horrible for you, because everything at year change turned into the other direction. So I think it makes sense to have some sort of diversification in different business models, then not get too defensive because you got bruised over the last few months, but keep on searching for great opportunities that give you also great upside.
I think it's a predicament for a lot of investors that it depends when you start your career. So obviously, if you start just before the correction, it will shape you in a certain way. Or if you have your first years during a really strong bull market, it will shape you in a different way. But also the other thing that I noticed is that decade after decade, we start to accumulate and expand the range of outcomes. And especially on the downside, we realize things can go really, really wrong. And I think there's a certain moment in our careers, and I notice it with some of my colleagues that are closer to retirement or already retired, that they've seen so much of the bad that their imagination leaves very little room for the good. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts. And you spoke about Jason Zweig. I listened to his interview with William Green not long ago, and he mentions how Benjamin Graham, that we all know very well, in the last years of his career, he exited the market. He didn't want to participate. He was waiting for the Great Depression to happen all over again, 3-4 decades after the Great Depression. Do you have some thoughts about that? How not to scare yourself out of the market after seeing more and more and more in your career?
Yeah. I think like Benjamin Graham, if you went through the 30s and no matter how smart you were or conservative, you still lost 80-90% of your wealth. I think that made an impression on you that you cannot leave behind you easily. But I try to stay open-minded, and I think you have to consciously work on it every day and check your biases. We all have them, and I have them plenty, but I try to detect them and then maybe also write about them and have some sort of catharsis by recognizing them and saying to them, like in a meditation, oh yeah, here you are, I put you here and you stay there and leave me alone for the future. So you have to keep on working on that. And by mentioning William Green, I mean, he's one person I could listen to for hours, because yes, he had all these conversations with the great investors, and there's so much wealth and knowledge in there and wisdom. That the one red line I always see is that all the great investors, they're always reflecting, they're always asking themselves, am I still on top of my game? Am I still learning? I think we have to stay learning machines. We're never allowed to shut down and say, that's the knowledge and I know better. The world is always evolving and changing. And if it cannot keep pace, then we should just stop it and do something else probably. But I think that's the great thing in the things we do, that it's always something new. There's always something to learn. It's never stopping. So I hope on the last day of my life, I'll be able to say, I'll start something new today. And because I don't know that my life will end at the end of the day, but maybe I'll still start something new. I'll learn something new and keep on evolving.
You're right. William Green has done a remarkable job in a way reintroducing us to people that we knew, but he has a way of bringing them closer to us. At least that's how I see his writing and his curiosity, that we get to know the people behind the names and the legends that we're familiar with to some extent, but they're human beings like all of us. And he talks about the challenges and life experience. It's really remarkable how he can profile the minds of investing in a way that I haven't seen anywhere else.
That's true.
One of your essays is titled, Am I Sure? And I thought it was a really cheeky title, and I always look for cheeky titles. And you talk about your conviction in your process. And I like the word conviction. I feel like we could have a whole conversation about conviction. And there's this mindset that you can copy other people's ideas, right? I can look up Warren Buffett's portfolio and I can copy. We all can, but you can't copy somebody's conviction behind an idea. Can you talk more about your thoughts behind this article, Am I Sure, and your process and your conviction? I'm curious to hear.
I mean, the whole thing with Am I Sure started because I'm always writing my German newsletter because that's my mother tongue. And then I translate it into English with DeepL. Then I read through it and change some things. And then I have another native speaking colleague, Martin. He reads over it because sometimes things sound awkward. So, yeah. That's the process, how it works. But my 5-year-old, he always says, and he said that yesterday, if I tell him something, he looks at me and says, echt jetzt? And he says, really? Is it really true? I said, we should have the same ethos. If someone tells us something, an investment story, or if you see some interesting opportunity, we should always ask, echt jetzt? Am I sure? Mm-hmm. Is that true? And question it. So I think a good dose of skepticism protects you from a lot of stupidity. So that was the one angle. And conviction, I think, is important. Our line of business investing is full of contradictions. And because you have to have strong convictions, but loosely held. So if you have no strong conviction, you cannot go through the difficult times. You cannot hold on to your investment when the price goes down. But at some point, you also have to recognize that you might be wrong, and so hold it loosely. And that's obviously a contradiction and very difficult thing to put together in your head. And also as an organization, Gutmann, on our walls, there is the tagline conviction and convenience, because convenience, because we want to make business as convenient as possible for our clients, which is difficult in this heavy regulatory environment where you have to have, I don't know, 20 signatures to open an account, but we try to make it convenient. And on the other hand, we must have convictions, because if we don't have convictions, how do we expect our clients to hold on in difficult times, to keep their trust in difficult times? So we have to give our clients the conviction. And there's also a contradiction there, because we have conviction doesn't mean that we have to fall into commitment and consistency. So telling our clients, that's what you should do, that's what the markets will do. And then the world changes and we keep holding that opinion. So we also have to keep a door open that we say we can always change our opinion. So there's another contradiction. So yeah, we have to give them conviction, but we also have to make them clear that conviction is until the moment where we decide that we want to change the course in your interest.
I'm thinking that conviction gives us courage in a way. And in the markets, we do need courage. And we both need courage to buy or sell if it's the right thing to do. And then the courage to sit it out, sometimes to sit things out. And whether it's sitting out the cryptocurrency craziness, or if it's sitting out a market low, or if it's sitting out a market peak. And listening to you, I was thinking how I often start my research with talking myself out of an idea. So I found it, and I find it appealing, and I'm finding all the reasons why I shouldn't own it and what can go wrong with it. And if I can't convince myself that despite of my initial excitement, it's still a good idea, then I'll go ahead. But I'm trying to talk myself out of it. And it's funny, because then when I share the idea with somebody else, they immediately come up with all the things. And I say, well, I already thought about it. Give me something else that I haven't thought about to talk myself out of that idea. I want to ask you about, you know, recent years, especially 2020. And there was one essay as I was going through them that really stood out. And it was from mid-2020. And people might be listening to this years from now thinking, what was it like to invest during the pandemic? And you write, going completely out of the stock market never makes sense, no matter what development you expect. And I thought it's such a powerful statement, even if it's the only statement from that essay. And then you explain your thinking behind it. But tell me more. Going out of the market completely never makes sense. I agree with you, but I love the way you put it.
I mean, what shaped the thought was that over the decades, the worst outcomes I've seen were the ones where people got completely out. Because right. What I learned is they'll never come back, or come back much too late, or miss out. So I've never seen not a single case that had a good ending. Mm-hmm. And in some of my writings, I always refer to the Phil Fisher book, Uncommon Profits from Common Stocks, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And he has a one part in there where he exactly describes it. There it is for a single stock, but where he describes not one in 10 will come back in that stock. And if it's a long-term compounder, so to speak, and profit from that going out at the end again. And also right. Charlie Munger talks about if you are smart enough to or lucky enough to find a great company at a great price and you invest in it, and then you sell it and you want to buy it again, you have to make many more of these smart decisions that you luckily made once. Very unlikely, so rather do nothing. And all these things together, I think, as a general rule, it's not a good idea to go completely out. When some years ago, when the smartphone was not as prevalent, I said, I also said at one conversation or talking to our clients, I said, many of the European investors are like the old phones. So they are where you turned it off in the evening and you turned it on in the morning. They're looking at investing like that. They say, is it time to buy again? Is it time to sell again? And they're always thinking, buying stocks and then selling them all and being cash again. So purely market timing. And I said, that's not a good strategy. You have to be like the modern smartphones. You have to be always on. And yes. I think that's really the lesson is don't go out completely, even if you're super negative. And I go even one step further. I think for an investor that wants to be 60% in equities, it doesn't make sense to go down to 20 and it doesn't make sense to go to 100. So you have to have boundaries to protect yourself probably between 50 and 70. So, okay, maybe you're negative. You go from 60 to 55. And if everything is collapsing and you think the world will go under, maybe you go to 50, but you shouldn't do anything beyond that because I've seen it so many times. The outcome is just horrible. You think it's the brilliant thing to do in that moment because your crocodile brain tells you, but that's just not the case. So have a strategy, define boundaries and pray every day that you will not abandon them in difficult times.
I wrote a piece that I called The Best Time Is Now because I get asked those questions both at the bottom or at the top. If it's the time to get in or get out. And the truth be told, you know, managing money for families, we're always in, sometimes a little bit more, sometimes a little bit less. And it changes and evolves. And we may have cash pile up at times if there are more things we would rather trim than buy. But exiting completely the market, it's not something that we would ever do. But for a small investor that's doing it on their own, I think the emotional discipline that we started the conversation with, it can get to them. The fear can really scare them out of the market. And then they come back when the neighbor is getting richer. And it's the worst time to come back.
Sure.
Robert, go ahead.
Just one thing that I think there's this old saying, is it African or whatever, that the best time to plant a tree was 30 years ago and the second best time is today. I completely agree with you. The best time is now. That's what I also would always advise. What is the best time to invest? It's always now. You have to start something at least today. And I've also seen that with clients that really that were sitting on 100% cash pool. And I said, they were so panic stricken. Oh, should I go in now? And I said, don't make your life so difficult. Just start a little bit. Just put in 10%. Just get started. Because as soon as you get started, it's like you put your foot into the water. It changes everything. It changes the perspective. And then everything else is much easier. So you have to start at least with something and not make a 0-100 decision.
I like what you mentioned a minute ago. So I see investing as a lifelong pursuit, whether you're doing it on your own or you're guided by some outside advisor and help. But it's a lifelong pursuit. And you mentioned how some people see it as, I'll go in for the 6 months or a year when the market is good. I'll make money, I'll exit, and I'll come back in 5 years. And it doesn't work that way. I mean, it works for a broker that makes commissions on your activity. But it doesn't work as an investment philosophy. So the moment you can appreciate and see it as a lifelong pursuit, whether you go in, as you said, 5, 10, 15%, as much as you feel comfortable, but see it as a lifelong pursuit, not something you can do in allegedly good times and then in the seemingly bad times you're out because you're asking for too much. Nobody can.
Exactly. It's so true. It's so true. And I also tell clients, if you don't believe me, just look how the largest wealths in the world have been created. It has not been done through buying and selling. Just look at Berkshire Hathaway and Warren Buffett. The big wealth didn't come through buying, selling, but the bulk of the money came from the entrepreneurial yield, so to speak. So holding on to companies over a very, very, very long time and let it compound. I mean, recently from the last letter, there was this discussion about Coca-Cola where someone showed their performance since 1994. That was the year they stopped buying Coca-Cola after 7-year buying streak. and mm-hmm. saying, and it underperformed the S&P. Well, so what? I wish my father bought Coca-Cola mm-hmm. in 1994 and held it on till today. I don't care about the benchmark. I only care mm-hmm. what the great compounding effect it has been over decades. I mean, that's a fabulous outcome. If that's mm-hmm. the worst that happens to you, that's fantastic. The comparison was not fair because Buffett bought most of the stock in 87. It was a big chunk of Berkshire's equity, and that was certainly at much lower prices. So if you benchmark it to another year, it looks also different. But that's for another conversation.
No, but I like the idea how, you know, we're sold on this, buy this stock because there's a 20% upside. A lot of sell side when they produce reports, which I don't read. Somebody asked me recently if you read sell side reports. I choose not to. And they talk about the 15-20% upside, and that's why I should buy it. I'm curious more if this company can compound the wealth of our clients and my own at a respectable rate over the long run. And it's a very different conversation and a very different mindset. It's more of the mindset that you talk about, buying Coca-Cola in the late 1980s or early 1990s and seeing it grow and succeed. And then I like what you pointed out. We didn't talk about benchmarks. We didn't talk about outperforming. And we've been talking about investing for an hour. And I love this because it's the mindset that we have. You know, the benchmarks are there, but you can't live your life by the benchmark. And the one thing that I learned is there are people behind the portfolios. And at the university, they teach you some theories and models. But at the end of the day, you have to sit down with somebody and ask them, will you be able to sleep with this kind of a portfolio? And somebody will sleep with a portfolio that has 5% stocks, and the other one is very comfortable with 100% stocks. Whatever it is, it's a human being at the end of the day behind the portfolio. So the outperformance or the efficient allocation or whatever term you want to throw out, the conversation shifts to a whole different level once you have a human being sitting across the table from you. And I think that's something that should be taught at schools. I hope it's taught at schools more now than 20 years ago when I was at the university, but that's my thought about it.
Yeah, you were right. I like what you've been saying. And in the beginning of what you just said, that reminded me of your writing where your partner called you. And you say your partner likes to call you and ask you some thought-provoking questions, and he asks you what would be the one single stock you would buy and hold forever, and you had an immediate answer, but you didn't reveal the stock. So after our conversation, I'll ask you on that one too.
I'll tell you.
You made me nosy.
My compliance reads the transcript, so we can't mention the name, but I'll tell you after. Listen, Robert, I have one last question, and I always like to ask that. Your own definition of success. How do you know you're on track? Is it a destination? Is it a journey? I'm always curious what my guests think about it.
Good point. Good question. Success. Recently, I came across a picture on LinkedIn that I liked, and I downloaded it. And this is how we are taught to measure success. And there is a pie chart, so to speak. Half of it is salary and half of it is job title. Mm-hmm. And that's really true. That's how we are taught. So what's your job and how much money do you make?
Right.
But if you think about it, there's so much more to it. And whoever did it put another measure below it, and there are many more pies in there, and job title and salary might be 10% each. And then there is mental health, physical health, liking what you do, free time. And I completely underwrite that. So I think that is also a benefit. I was never driven by career or money thoughts. I always wanted to do something that had a purpose and that fulfilled me and that I loved. And that's also why I came back to Vienna after 27 years of being away and joining Goodman. And looking around, I love working with my colleagues, with the management of the company. It's always stimulating. We want to get the best results for our clients. I'm like Warren Buffett, step dancing to work every day. And even if I'm in the home office, I'm still step dancing.
Uh-huh.
So I think that's so important to be part of something that you like and love, and then the rest will come with it. Over time, you will have found your place in the organization, and you will add to the results. And I think, yeah, success is so much more. And if you only work and cannot care for your family or don't see your kids, what kind of success is that? So I think the world has changed a lot from where we have been some decades ago, and it's now much easier, I think, also to go in that direction and still be a very productive member of an organization and add to the bottom line. Because I understand that as a company has to be viable, has to be successful, and we want to succeed with what we do. But that doesn't contradict or mean that we have to neglect the other things.
Well, I can relate to it. And I think you can tell that I love what I do. And I feel very fortunate that I even get paid to do it.
That's what I always say. Don't tell them. Don't tell them that we would do it for free.
I think it's a bonus. But, you know, reading, learning, exploring, and we talked about it a lot. The world keeps on changing. And being able to stay on top of things and just staying curious and learning the world through the companies that we invest in, it's so much fun. I like the idea that you mentioned the last day of your life. You hope that in the morning you're still embarking on something new. And I think that's what how Buffett and Munger look at the world. And I think we can learn from them. Never stop and keep on learning and keep that curiosity alive. And I think that's a fun way to live a very fulfilling life. And if money follows, that's great. Robert, I learned a lot. I really enjoyed it. And I will include all the links in the notes so that people can follow your writing in both languages and everything you do. And thank you again for this time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Bogumil. It was great talking to you. Enjoyed it a lot.
You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes only, and so are the opinions of members of Seekard Associates, a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments, or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on Seekard Associates is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents available at advisorinfo.sec.gov.